For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So this event is also being co-sponsored by Buddhist Peace Fellowship Chicago, and I'm Taigen Layton from the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate Temple on Irving Park Road, and I wanted to mention that David Loy will be also speaking there tomorrow morning at 10:15 on the Bodhisattva path and how it is adjusting and needs to adjust to the current situation in the West. Today, David will speak on why Buddhism and the modern world need each other, related topics. David is one of the most eminent Zen authors about how Buddhism is finding its way in our current situation. His many books include A New Buddhist Path, Enlightenment, Evolution, and Ethics in the Modern World, The Great Awakening, A Buddhist Social Theory, A Buddhist History of the West, Studies in Lack, The Dharma of Dragons and Demons, Buddhist Themes in Modern Fantasy, and Money, Sex, War, Karma, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. So David writes in a very entertaining and really relevant way about how the Buddhist teaching, the Buddhist Dharma, relates to our current situation and current issues. David is also a Zen teacher in the Sanbo Kyodan tradition. He also now teaches, leads meditation retreats at the Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center, of which he's a founding member. So you can look at rockymountainecodharmaretreat.org to find out about his events. He's been on the faculty at many universities, including Xavier University in Cincinnati and universities in Japan. So I'm very happy to have David visiting us in Chicago this weekend. So thank you very much, David.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, to Taigen Dan Layton for making the connection, but also to Tom and to Charles and indeed to the university for this opportunity. I don't know if anyone was here. Was it 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, I gave another talk. So I'm very delighted to be able to come back again, especially to talk about a topic that is of real love and concern to me, that is to say, the relationship between Buddhism and the modern world. Let me check. Can everyone hear me okay? Am I speaking loud enough? Any problems? If anything happens, just raise your hand and we'll try to adjust. I'd like to begin with a quotation from Gary Snyder, the Zen poet. Way back in the 1960s, he published an essay on Buddhist anarchism that included these now famous words, quote, "The mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the self / void." I think now we would say something like individual insight into the emptiness of the self, something like that. And then he ended by saying, we need both. And this is what I really want to elaborate on. Another way of trying to express what I think he's trying to get at is to say that the emphasis of the West, which is no longer just the West, I think that to a large extent, what we think of as the Western tradition has been the main impetus behind globalization, right? But the main concern of the West has been, not concern, the highest ideal of the Western tradition has been social justice. Notice that I use the word ideal, because needless to say, in many ways, we fall short of that. And in some ways, we seem to be going backwards, right? But nonetheless, we have this ideal that we can transform how it is that we live together so that we have a more socially just society. And I think here all of us are very well aware how much we fall short of that, as I said, but it's also really important to appreciate how much has been achieved in the last few hundred years, which is just a kind of blip in, you know, human history. If you think about it, we've had religious reformations, allowing for religious freedom. We've had political revolutions, overthrowing kings and so forth, leading to democracy. We've had anti-slavery movements and more recently civil rights movements. We've had women's rights, women's movements, and more recently all of the things going on with gender, gay rights, and so forth. If you think about it, a lot has been accomplished in a relatively short period of time. But it is also striking, I think, that in some ways we also feel that there's some resistance to that, that something seems to be happening that keeps us from that movement, that general concern for social restructuring, that keeps it from being it, from that being as successful as we would like it to be. And certainly these days, in the last few years, we can feel that very strongly. And so that's one important question to keep in the back of your minds. What is it that's resisting, you know, this historically important movement, right? On the other side, coming to the Buddhist side, social transformation has never been an important aspect of the Asian Buddhist tradition, with one exception that I'll be talking about a bit later, that is to say the Buddha himself, which I think was a lot more progressive than the institution that developed after his death. But in general, the emphasis in Buddhism has not been about social transformation, but about individual transformation, right? The focus has really been very much on our own individual dukkha, that is to say suffering in the broad sense, but understood in terms of our own past actions, our own past karma, the way that our own mind works. And so traditionally, Buddhism hasn't been concerned about what we might call social dukkha, or institutionalized or structural dukkha, the suffering caused by inequitable societal structures, right? So we can see there's a pretty interesting contrast between the emphasis in the West on social transformation and the interest, the focus in traditional Asian Buddhism on individual transformation. And what I think we can see today, maybe this is a consequence of the kind of globalization that's been going on, but also in response to the kind of situation that we now find ourselves in, which to me, to be quite honest, I think we're in a time where our civilization seems to be self-destructing in some ways, certainly ecologically, and one wonders more so, right? So what I think we can see now is that these two ideals, these two projects, it's not only that they go well together, but I think we can also see that actually they need each other. That's the main argument I want to make, that neither of them by themselves can be as successful as we need them to be without the other. And that, I think, is maybe a special legacy of our time, that I think we can see that more clearly than people could maybe in the past. So that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about why these two projects, social transformation and individual transformation, why they not only go well together, but in a sense that they need each other if either is to be as successful as we need them to be. Does that make any sense? Now, as a way to approach that, because that's a pretty big topic, right? As a way to approach it, I want to look at the ethical. And when I say ethical, I don't mean the ethical content. That is to say, I want to make a contrast between the Abrahamic, especially the Judeo-Christian tradition, and the Buddhist tradition in regard to their attitude toward ethics, morality. But I'm not so much interested in the content, right? It's like I don't want to compare the Ten Commandments with, say, the five precepts of Buddhism. Rather, I'm more concerned to look about the role of the moral or the ethical in the larger context, because that's where I think it gets quite interesting. What I'm pointing at here is basically the fact that I think in the Abrahamic traditions, morality or the ethics is much more central than it is in the case of Buddhism. That is to say, I think in the Abrahamic, like the central axis, the central issue is good versus evil. At least that's the way it's been understood. As opposed to Buddhism, where the central axis is not good versus evil, although that plays a role, but the central issue is delusion versus wisdom, or ignorance versus awakening. And that's quite an interesting contrast there, right? So let me start with the Abrahamic and kind of defend the claim that good versus evil is like the fundamental issue. In all the Abrahamic, right, we believe in a God. And when you ask, what is his way of relating to us? What's his main way of relating to us? What's our main way of relating to him? I think that highlights the ethical very quickly, right? God tells us how to live. The implication being, if we disobey, if we don't live in the way that he wants us to live, the repercussions probably won't be good. But if we do live in the way that he wants us to live, somehow we'll be taken care of, right? You can understand that in the usual terms of heaven and hell. But basically, what I'm trying to say is that at the very heart of the Abrahamic traditions is this kind of moral demand, this moral expectation, right? And it goes all the way back to the beginning of human history, according to Genesis. That is to say, the story of Adam and Eve, right? Why do they get kicked out of the garden? Because they disobeyed God. That story is quite interesting from a Buddhist perspective, which emphasizes something different, that when they eat the apple, they become self-conscious, right? And that's why they have to find fig leaves to sort of hide their nakedness. I think that's the metaphor, that's the implication, that they have become self-conscious in a way that they weren't before. And from that perspective, you could say that, are they really kicked out of the garden, or in the act of becoming self-conscious, have they separated themselves from the garden? That is to say, they're not part of the garden anymore. Now they might be in it, but they still feel this sense of separation, right? Anyway, we can elaborate on that from a Buddhist perspective, but that's not what the traditional Abrahamic emphasizes, right? The emphasis is sin. They sin, they disobeyed God, and they're thereby kicked out of the garden, right? And it carries on. Story of Noah. Why does God send a flood that drowns just about everyone except the people and the animals in the ark? Because we are not living in the way that God wants us to. So it's his kind of punishment. A little bit of an overreaction, I think. All the animals who were drowned, were they all evil? You know, and this is the question I've never read an answer to. What about all the evil fish, right? Did they get away easy, right? And it carries on down then to Moses and the sort of heart of the Old Testament, the Hebrew tradition, the idea of the covenant between God and humanity, whereby Moses goes up to the top of the mountain. Is it Ararat he goes up to the top of? And comes back with the Ten Commandments, right? Some years ago, I had an opportunity to spend some time with some archaeologists in Jerusalem, and they told me what they claimed was the true story of what happened there. And they said that actually what happened was when Moses went up to the top of the mountain the first time and he came down, of course, he saw that the Israelites were worshiping false gods and so forth, and he got angry and he broke the tablets and he had to go up again. And when he came down the second time, he gathered the Israelites around him and he said, I have good news and I have bad news. Right? The good news is I've got them down to 10. But the bad news is adultery is still in. Actually, what those archaeologists told me, interestingly, is that there's absolutely no scientific, historical, archaeological support for the fact that Moses ever existed. They're quite sure that he never did, that it's a myth that was invented by the Israelites to kind of distinguish themselves from other peoples living in the area. But that's marginal to our story today, right? And then it goes on to Jesus, okay? Now, Jesus emphasizes love, I think, more, maybe with a bit of help from Paul here. He seems to have a more intimate relationship with God, right? He calls him Abba. And I think some of you here know this far better than I do, but it translates literally as something like daddy. But nonetheless, there's also a sense in which he's fundamentally an apocalyptic prophet. He's telling people, wake up, the last times are coming soon. You better shape up. You better live in the way that God wants you to, right? And by now you're wondering, why am I going on and on at such length about this? And the answer is very simple, that even though in some ways we live in a society that, if not post-Christian, at least it's a case where it's not as Christian as it used to be, nonetheless, here's the point. Good versus evil, which is at the heart of the Judeo-Christian story, is still our favorite story. It's still the one that we like the most. It makes a lot of sense, too, if you think about it. It's very simple. I mean, think about our favorite movies. I'm old enough that I grew up with James Bond, right? What's the story? Good versus evil. But also, just tick them off, Star Wars, right? Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, need I go on? You know, we can add to it, you know, a lot of our favorite murder mysteries and so forth and so on. We love this story so much. But from a Buddhist perspective, although there's something wonderful about this story, this fundamental good versus evil, this way of organizing the world, perceiving the world, orienting us in terms of how to live in the world, although we love this story, from a Buddhist perspective, there's not only something wonderful about it, but there's also something very problematical. And let me start with the problematical. From a Buddhist perspective, good versus evil is a very good example, maybe the archetypal example of what's sometimes called dualistic thinking or bipolar thinking. That is to say, thinking that works in terms of opposites. Other good examples, big, small, high, low. We can all think of dozens of examples, right? What's interesting about these concepts is that if you think about it, let's say big, small. It seems like we have two concepts, big, small. But if you think about it a little bit, well, if you don't really understand what big means, you don't really understand small, do you? You don't really have two separate concepts. You have two sides of the same concept, which might seem like a kind of a piddling logical point, but it's actually very important psychologically as well. The fact that you cannot have one without the other, that big has no meaning without small, that psychologically, therefore, too, you cannot distinguish them. Let me give you an example. Let's take this example, pure, impure. That's a good example of dualistic thinking. Again, purity and impurity are not only logically but psychologically dependent on each other, which means if you want to live a pure life, whatever that means to you, we're not interested in the details, but if you want to live a pure life, it means you are going to live your life preoccupied with impurity. Because the whole concept of purity has no meaning except insofar as it distinguishes itself from impurity. You can't say, I'm going to be pure. In order to be pure, you have to distinguish every situation, every response into, is this pure or is this impure? You can't have one lens without the other, you see? Does that make any sense? That's why one of the great Chinese Chan masters, Hui Hai, said, true purity is to live beyond the duality of purity and impurity. Not to be caught up in that, not to see the world through those lenses, not to organize the world in that way. And as I said, the archetypal example of this dualistic thinking is good versus evil. And in this case, we could say, we can't know what's good until we know what's evil, because good is that which distinguishes itself from evil. And if you want to really feel good about yourself as being a good person, the best way to do it is to be fighting against the evil, preferably, of course, an evil outside yourself. So we get caught up in these kind of dualisms that I think have been so important in the history of the West, if we just want to look at Europe, for example. How important Satan has been, right? How we've had to have a Satan, otherwise God's goodness doesn't make sense in quite the right way. We end up with this kind of battle between them, to the point where, you know, some very conservative evangelical Christians will understand the world as this fundamental battleground between the forces of God and the forces of Satan, and the really important question is which side you're on, you know? This whole thing between good and evil, historically, heresy trials, witchcraft trials, what happened, say, when the Europeans went to the New World and they found the religions, the local religions, and how they were satanic, how they had to be destroyed, right? But we don't have to go back that far. I'm thinking of James Bond again. I'm assuming most of you are familiar with at least some of those films. They keep resurrecting and redoing them, don't they? Here's an interesting question. Why do we know that James Bond is a good guy? I mean, in some ways, you know, he likes to drink, he likes to gamble, he has casual relations with a lot of women, a lot of whom die along the way, right? How do we know he's a good guy? For one reason, he's fighting against the bad guys, you see? That's what makes him good. But I don't think we have to stick to fictional movies in this case, right? I'm thinking actually now of the War on Terror. Right? What was the difference between Osama bin Laden and President George W. Bush? In one way they were opposites, but in another way they were fighting the same holy war, because it is a holy war, of good against evil. What the one thought was good, the other thought was evil, and vice versa, but nonetheless it's the same mentality, right? And, of course, once you've labeled something as evil, this is the other scary thing about it, once you've actually labeled something as evil, you don't have to understand it, and ideally you shouldn't negotiate it. If it's evil, what should you do? Destroy it, right? Extirpate it. So this is kind of, this gets into some scary situations. I'm thinking, for example, what about somebody like Hitler? What was Hitler trying to do? I mean, for all of us, he's kind of the archetypal evil person. But in his own mind, he was trying to purify the earth of its impure elements, right? Of its evil elements, the Jews, the homosexuals, the communists, and so forth, right? Or what about Stalin in the Soviet Union? Why is he trying to get rid of the kulaks, the slightlier, whether wealthier peasants? Or Mao Zedong in China with the landlords. In a way, what they're all doing is trying to sort of perfect the earth, to make it good by somehow, one way or another, getting rid of the evil, that which interferes with the complete victory of goodness. Which leads to this incredible paradox, and this is the focal point. Historically, and we can still see this happening, one of the main causes of evil in the world is our attempts to get rid of evil. Do you see the point? One of the main causes of evil has been our attempts to get rid of evil, which is a critique of that rather simplistic way, good versus evil, we're the good guys, they're the evil guys. And certainly that applies today to what we call the war on terrorism, right? So that's the problematic side. Looking at this fundamental duality of good versus evil from a Buddhist perspective, I see that as the problematical side. But there's also something very wonderful about it, too. And to this, I would go back to the Old Testament prophets. What were the prophets concerned about doing? Well, one of the main things they were concerned about was going up and sort of challenging, or at least questioning, the rulers, right? Going up to the rulers and saying, you are not living in the way that God wants you to, right? You are oppressing the orphans and the widows. You are taking advantage of them, and God is going to punish you for it. This is not the way that you should live, right? And then they would scurry back into the hills, because if you sort of challenge the rulers, you better get away from them, right? But what do they, in the process of doing that, what did they really sort of enshrine? You know, it's again the idea that, you know, morality isn't something that the powerful use to control the governed. Rather, it's something that applies to everybody alike, that God is going to judge rulers as well. And therefore, the issue of good versus evil isn't just an individual issue, but it has to do with society, the way that society is organized. And if we bring this concern, this social justice concern, if we bring this together with the other root of Western civ, that is to say the Greeks, because we often trace back the roots of Western civilization to Jerusalem and Athens, or to the Jewish people and to classical Greece. What did the Greeks realize? Well, their great discovery that somehow today we take for granted is the realization that human society isn't natural in the way that ecosystems are. I see a lot of blank looks now. What I mean by that is, if you go back before the Greeks, if you look at, say, the Egyptians, Mesopotamians, Incas, Aztecs, Maya, they all had the idea that not only did you have this sort of natural world, but human society, hierarchically organized, was also part of the natural world. You couldn't just change it. It was just natural and, in a sense, sacred. You know, you might knock off the guy at the top and take his place, but the fundamental organization was natural, and therefore you just had to accept it. And what the Greeks came along and said, what they realized is, no, human society is different. If we don't like the way our human society is organized, we can reorganize it. And they created democracy as a solution to particular kind of social tensions that arose in Athens at a certain time. And so that's why they were able to create what we call democracy. By our standards, not a very good one, you know. Women and slaves needn't apply. But nonetheless, the fundamental principle of the demos, of the people, of the populace, somehow ruling. So you bring these two principles together. The Greek idea that we can restructure society, and the prophetic Hebrew Jewish idea of concern for social justice. You bring those two together, especially in the modern world, and what do you get? You get the kinds of things that I started out talking about. You get revolutions, liberation movements, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. You get the kind of social transformation that all of us here are benefiting from, right? And as a result of all of these coming together, we now live in an almost perfect society. Thank you. I needed the laugh at that point, right? Right? Because as we said at the beginning, a lot's been achieved, but nonetheless, there does seem like there's some resistance, some pushback, especially now, right? The last year or so. So, and we may wonder, well, what's going on here? Here's one way to say it. Supposing that all of us here lived in the most perfect possible society, whatever that means, best possible economic system, best possible political system. Suppose we all lived in this society, which in the way it's structured couldn't be better, and yet we as individuals are still motivated by what Buddhism calls the three poisons: greed, ill will, delusion. Suppose we all have a lot of these in us, even though we're living in the perfect society, how well is that society going to function? Do you see my point? It's like, in fact, the more you think about it, is that kind of like what's happened, right? In the sense that people, especially powerful people, are thereby going to somehow subvert those institutions for their own benefit. Let me say it another way. Supposing that you are the ruler of a small country where you've just had a revolution. You're a revolutionary leader. You've overthrown this really nasty dictator, and now you have all the power in your hands. But and your goal is to restructure it and make it a socially just society. But you've still got more than a little bit of these three poisons within you. That is to say, if you're still got some greed, some tendency to take advantage of the situation, you know, aren't you going to use your position for your own personal benefit? If you've got ill will, what Buddhism identifies as the second poison, aggression, sometimes it's called hatred, you're probably going to identify people who have different ideas, people who disagree with you, who suggest things should be done differently. You'll tend to identify them as problems to be controlled, if not eliminated, right? And if you still have the delusion of ego, right? You still have the delusion that you understand the situation better than anyone else, and all that has to happen is for everyone just to do what you say. You know, what's going to happen? Are you going to end up at this great utopia? Or is what's going to happen what so often happens? That is to say, you end up replacing one gang of thugs with another, right? Do you see my point? So what I'm trying to say here is that as wonderful, as important as the Western tradition ideal of social transformation, social justice has been, I think we can see pretty clearly that that is inadequate, that that can't take us where we want to go without personal transformation. And I think what's happened in the last few years in this country shows that pretty clearly, to be quite frank, although I'm not going to go into details, right? So does that make any sense? If you're with me this far, I've kind of made half my argument, right? Right? Why the Western concern for social transformation needs to sort of bring in this other concern, right? But let's now shift to the other side. Let's shift to the Buddhist emphasis on individual transformation. But please excuse me a moment. You may remember that I started out talking about different attitudes toward morality, right? And how good versus evil is at the real heart of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And it's important within Buddhism, certainly, right? It's like that's kind of a foundation. In Buddhism, we talk about the five precepts. But nonetheless, there's a sense in which the ultimate goal in Buddhism isn't simply behaving morally. There's something to realize. There's something to understand. There's a kind of transformation in the way that we experience the world and ourselves that's called awakening or enlightenment. And that transformation somehow is the crucial thing. There's even the sense that if that transformation occurs, if we're able in the practice to transform ourselves in a way, we don't have to worry about morality, because in principle, we won't be inclined to abuse others. I say in principle, we can get into the discussions of all of the counterexamples. But nonetheless, the idea that somehow, ultimately, the precepts and morality generally are something like the training wheels in a bicycle. That they're really very helpful when you're learning to ride a bike, but ultimately, you can take them off. Because once you know how to ride the bike, you're not likely to fall down. So this is the fundamental idea. So because of that, as I said earlier, the other thing that goes along with good versus evil, which is this concern for justice, that hasn't been important in the Buddhist tradition. What's the closest that you might get to that? Some people might say karma, but it's interesting that it really hasn't served that function. We could, you know, some people might say that karma actually blows up the concept of good versus evil to cosmic dimensions. It says that the universe is really, there's this good, evil inherent within it, which is actually a misunderstanding, because the focus in karma is not about good versus evil. It's all about cause and effect. Good is our label. You know, we might label it in terms of we look at it in that context. But more importantly, the way that karma has actually functioned historically is to actually discourage us from becoming socially engaged, I think, because if morality is already built into the cosmos, we don't have to worry about it. It'll take care of itself. In fact, it's already taken care of itself. Right now, each of us is born, reborn in the situation that we are now because of what we did in past lifetimes, right? So in a way, the belief in karma as some kind of cosmological law has sort of reduced concern for the social justice. It's already built there. We don't have to really worry about it very much, right? So what is, if justice is so important, right? So we have this, what is it? Good, evil, sin, repentance, forgiveness. If we have this kind of constellation here, what's the equivalent constellation? We've already said a little bit, right? Delusion, wisdom, or ignorance, awakening. What's the other really important concept here that's connected with delusion, wisdom? And what I think it comes down to is, in fact, what's the most important concept in all of Buddhism, which is to say dukkha, which I mentioned at the very beginning. The word usually translated into English is suffering, right? It only works. Suffering only works if you understand it in the broadest possible sense, right? Not just physical and mental pain, but frustration, dissatisfaction, anxiety, or my favorite, dis-ease. So if the concern in the Abrahamic tradition is sin, the concern in Buddhism is dukkha, suffering. And obviously there's a lot of overlap and relationship, but they're not exactly the same thing, right? And here's the really interesting question for the Buddhist tradition. Exactly what did the Buddha have in mind when he said, what I teach is dukkha and how to end it? Likewise, the Four Noble Truths, they're all about dukkha, cause of dukkha, end of dukkha, how to end dukkha with the Eightfold. So dukkha is clearly the big thing. But what did the Buddha have in mind? It's very clear the way the tradition developed is that it came to understand dukkha in very individual terms. Right? As I said earlier, it came to understand dukkha in terms of my own mind, my own karma from what I did in past lifetimes. And the focus is not on the way society is structured. It's not at all on the fact that you might have a really, really nasty, exploitive king there. It doesn't talk about that. It talks about your own mind, your own karma, right? Your own mental tendencies, your own delusion, and so forth. Very individualistic. That's the way the tradition developed. But here's the really interesting question. Is that actually what the Buddha had in mind? Did he understand it so narrowly? Because some scholars, I'm thinking of people like Trevor Lang and Nalin Swartz, some scholars think that actually the Buddha wasn't really so concerned about creating what we now understand as a religion, that he was actually starting a kind of revolution in society that would actually, at best, transform the whole of the society. Right? This is where we need to be careful. We have in the modern world a particular understanding of what a religion is, and then we kind of plug Buddhism into that. Maybe that wasn't what the Buddha was thinking, right? And the problem is, although we have all of these texts, we have hundreds of discourses by the Buddha in the Pali Canon, but it's very hard to say how complete it is. It's very hard to say how much. We know some things have been modified. That's pretty obvious. It's not clear from that. Basically, in other words, it's a big question mark. But what stands out for me, and what I want to spend a few minutes talking about, is the Buddha's attitude toward two things in particular, which suggests to me, at least, that the Buddha was far more progressive than the Buddhist institution that formed after he died. In particular, the two things that I have in mind are his attitude toward women and his attitude toward caste, right? So let me just go ahead and say a little bit about them. The situation of women at the time of the Buddha was not good, all right? It's pretty patriarchal society, and especially in religious terms, the main religions, they were rituals were conducted by Brahmin priests, and they were always men. Women couldn't get involved. They had to be really, you know, in fact, if they did chant the Vedas or something like that, they could get into a lot of trouble. I forget what it was. Was it cutting out their tongue or molten metal in their tongue or something? But basically, women were very much kind of chattel to a large degree. And in this regard, we can see in many ways the Buddha was a very progressive figure. First of all, we see it in his social teachings. His teachings about wives and husbands, very powerful in that he clearly understands the relationship between the man and the woman as a kind of there's a relationship in which each has responsibilities and privileges from the other. So it's not equal in modern terms, but nonetheless, for that time, it was incredible in terms of, you know, the men were expected to do certain things and the women were expected to do certain things. We would still find it, you know, sexist, but nonetheless, it wasn't simply that the women were chattel, by no means. There was a real sense of how the man, you know, the woman was there to take care of the household, etc., etc., and the man had responsibility to cherish the wife, to take care of her in certain kinds of ways. It's quite striking. Again, in its historical context, it's very, very progressive, right? But that's laywomen. What about women joining the monastic order, the Sangha that the Buddha created? And this is where I think Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, this is where he really stands out. Because in addition to establishing a bhikkhu sangha, that is to say an order of monastics for men, he also established a parallel bhikkhuni sangha, a monastic order for women. Let me ask, I wonder how many of you are familiar with the famous story in the Pali Canon where he creates this woman sangha? Anybody know it? A few people, right. It's quite an interesting story. And problematical one. I had a chance to talk about it with Bhikkhu Bodhi, who had some interesting insights into it. According to the story, the Buddha was approached by his foster mother, who basically raised him after his own mother died very soon after his birth. Again, this is according to the traditional, maybe mythic biographies. But anyway, he was approached by his foster mother. And she said, look, you've established this sangha for men. Women, too, we want the opportunity to follow this path, right? And the Buddha says, no, can't do it. Won't do it. And she and some other women, they keep pursuing him, and they're crying and tearing out their hair and say, we want a sangha, too. Buddha says, nope, won't do it. And they keep following him and ask him, I think it's the third time, he says no, then the Buddha is approached by Ananda, his attendant. And Ananda says to the Buddha, and I forget the exact words, but in effect it's something like this. He says, oh, world-honored one, don't women have the same Buddha nature, the same potential to awaken as men? And the Buddha says, yes. I'm shortening the story, right? The Buddha says yes, and then Ananda says, well, then why don't you create a sangha for them so they too can follow the holy path and all that? And the Buddha says, okay. And then he goes ahead, and he says, okay, there can be this woman sangha, provided, but first of all, he says, the women have to, in addition to all the rules and regulations that the men have to follow, there's some additional rules that the women have to follow. Some very heavy ones, they're called, heavy ones. And interestingly, one of the rules says that no woman monastic, no bhikkhuni, can ever criticize a male monastic. Even if she's been a nun for 50 years and this little kid has just been ordained today or yesterday, she cannot criticize him. Now, please think with me, what anxiety does that rule reveal on the part of the men, right? That's really quite striking. Maybe you won't be surprised if a lot of people suspect that the extra rules were added sometime later, maybe not given by the Buddha himself, right? In addition to that, the Buddha says something like, because I've ordained women, my dharma will decline and disappear from the earth that much earlier. You know, we have this teaching of the decline of the dharma, that slowly the teachings will decline. And because, the Buddha said, because I've created this sangha for women, it's going to happen actually much more quickly. Presumably because it's more corrupted by women or something like that, right? Very interesting story. And it's... we do not know if there's a core of truth to it, but there's all kinds of problems with this story that suggest it's not historically true. That it might, in fact, be something that was created or maybe added to or somehow reorganized much later. I used to love this story for the way that the Buddha allowed himself to be persuaded by his attendant. Isn't that kind of neat? He said, that's kind of cool. His attendant, his cousin, wow. And then I realized, oh no, that's really silly, David. The whole point of the story, at least that part of it, is to blame Ananda for what happened. Because if you read the Pali Canon, lots of the Pali Canon, there are lots of stories about Ananda, and almost all of them show him in a bad light. The redactors, the people who put the Pali Canon together, actually had it in for Ananda. And we can also see pretty clearly that there was some kind of struggle between Kashyapa, the guy who took over the Sangha after the Buddha died, and Ananda. There was some tension between them. I don't understand it, but it's very clear. And people... So the whole way the story is organized, I now suspect, and not just me, but it's a way to blame Ananda for what happened. In addition, something Bhikkhu Bodhi pointed out, it's believed that the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the woman Sangha, was created maybe 7 or 8 years after the Buddha began to teach. Now, the Buddha taught for 45 years, according to the official biographies. So this was fairly early in his career. But we know from other stories that Ananda did not become his attendant until much later. Right? There's other problems with the story. Let me just mention one more. The whole logic, again, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's point, and I think he's right. The whole logic of the story, the Buddha says, you know, no, I don't want to create this Sangha because, you know, if I create this, you know, by creating the Sangha, it's going to destroy what I've worked so hard to create more quickly. It'll destroy it more quickly. And Bhikkhu Bodhi said, well, that doesn't make sense. It's like, first of all, he lets the women in, and then he says, it's a terrible thing to do. Right? It's going to destroy my Sangha. Whereas if it were going to have that impact, it would be a lot more logical to say something like, look, Ananda, I'd like to create a woman's Sangha. I really would. But if I do, it's really going to damage my Dharma. So I'd like to do it, but I can't do it. You see the whole logic of the story. It just doesn't really make much sense. And that's very suggestive. In the context of all of that, it's important to remember that after the Buddha died, although I think of him as being quite progressive in his relations with women, what tended to happen is, well, and this is two ways of saying the same thing. On the one hand, men, every Asian Buddhist society became or reinforced its patriarchy. That is to say, every Asian Buddhist society to this day is very patriarchal. Also connected with this is the fact that the women sanghas in different countries, they all died out pretty quickly within a few hundred years. So even though the Buddha created this sangha for women, it didn't last. Why? Well, my guess is the men didn't like the competition, to be quite honest. And also, you have to remember, the monastics are dependent on public support. So if there's a lot of women as well, then the support is having to be shared by more people. That's all speculation. But nonetheless, what is clear is that the woman sangha died out. And for various legalistic reasons, now the men, the patriarchs in Buddhist societies, are saying, sorry, it cannot be revived. Now that it's died out, it cannot be revived. And there's this big struggle going on in Theravada countries like Thailand to try to revive it. And there's a huge resistance on the part of the official male monastic organization. So I'm just struck by the contrast, by a story that suggests the Buddha's, and by his whole career, it suggests that the Buddha was very liberated or very progressive about women in his own day. But after he died, the institution that formed reincorporated patriarchy, and what the Buddha started did not survive. It's very nice to know that in the West, for the most part, at least say in the Zen tradition, we now, which is what I'm trained in, we now have lots and lots of women teachers. There's still a problem with full ordination in the Theravada countries, and also in Tibet, and so forth. But nonetheless, I think in the West, as one would expect, Western practitioners will not put up with patriarchy in the same way, and the women are, a lot of them are very tough, and we're overcoming that, right? So that's one example, you see. To put it in context, the story there, what we've just said about women, suggesting that the Buddha wasn't just concerned about individual dukkha, but he understood he needed to create, it was important to create a sangha for women. It was important, and what's the implication of that? If women have the same potential to awaken as men, that's pretty powerful in a very, very patriarchal society, right? So that's one example. The other example I want to talk a little bit about is his attitude toward caste, right? Which might be the equivalent of something like our concerns about racism these days. That may be kind of the equivalent. It's very interesting. At the time of the Buddha, what I've read is that caste was not quite as rigid as it has become since, but it was still very important what caste you were from. You know, were you a Brahmin priest? Were you a Kshatriya warrior, which included the royalty, the kings, and so forth, right? Were you a merchant? Were you a farmer? Were you an outcast? That was pretty important stuff. And the interesting thing is, in the order that the Buddha created, when you joined the order, you lost all caste. Furthermore, my understanding is that you're not even supposed to talk about caste at all. It's just like that's one of those gossipy things that you're not supposed to sort of waste your time on, right? And another interesting fact is that, of course, the monastics, they're mendicants, right? They're beggars in the sense that every morning they get their food by taking their big bowl, and they go out and they go to the different households to beg for food. And you're not allowed to discriminate which household you go to. You see, in caste, one of the really, maybe the most important thing is it affects who can touch your food, who can cook your food, who you can eat your food with. And you're saying, okay, these, you could have a lower caste monastic, no, let's make it a Brahmin who now is a beggar. He's wearing these scraps that he's sewn together and washed and dyed, so he looks like an outcast. And he goes around, and he cannot discriminate. He has to go to a lower caste person, and he collects food from them if they offer it, just as he does from anyone. So again, incredibly democratic shift, right? Within the Buddhist tradition, the only distinction is how long you have been a monastic. That is to say, when you move to a new place or when you start eating, there's certain priority given to those who have been in the order the longest. So if you're a senior to somebody else, you have some small privileges that become very important, right? That's the only. So the only issue is not about caste or anything else. It's simply about how long you've been a monastic, right? And this brings me to what is my favorite story. There's actually at least two versions in the Pali Canon of this. Favorite story of what happened when there were a group of high caste, I think they were Kshatriya warrior types, right? There were a group of four or six who were off in the forest, and they decide that they want to join the Buddha's order. They want to become monastics. So they turn to their servant, Upali, who maybe is closer to a slave in modern terms, but they turn to Upali and they say, look, we're going to go join the order. We're going to become monastics. We don't need these fancy clothes. We're going to be wearing rags and so forth. So we're going to give you our fancy silk clothes and jewelry and all that, and we want you to take it back to our families. And Upali says, wait a minute, I can't do that. What happens if somebody sees me with these clothes and jewels and so forth? What will they think? They will think at the least that I robbed somebody, maybe that I killed you. I can't do that. It's too dangerous. So I better join the order too. So you have these high caste men and their servant slave, Upali, and they all go to the Buddha and they say, oh, world honored one, we want to join the Sangha. Please ordain us. And what does the Buddha do? The story, as I remember it, doesn't say anything about his motivation, but this is what I read into it, right? He looks them over, and you've got these four high caste young men. Does he ordain them? He sends them on a retreat. I forget, 2 weeks, a month retreat. He puts them on a retreat. Why? Well, we have to imagine, but my guess is something like this. You've got four spoiled young men. Can they really hack it as monastics begging for their food? Can they really take this lifestyle? So before I ordain them, let's check them out. So he puts them on a retreat. That's my speculation about his motivations. So they're gone in retreat. What about Upali? Does he send Upali on a retreat? He ordains Upali. Now please think for a minute what that means. Remember what I said about priority. It means that Upali will be forever their senior in the Sangha. Anytime it comes to any of those situations, he will be the one to make the decision. And his former masters will be after him. Does that touch you the way it touches me? What's going on there? Again, it's speculation on the motives, but that's just one of those stories that makes me think, wow, there was something really progressive about the Buddha, right? But once again, after he died, what happened with the institution? Especially in relationship to what you might call the powers that be, right? Because when you read the early stories, the early Sangha, it was to some degree dependent on royal support or at least royal toleration. That is to say, if the king didn't like what you were getting up to, especially in the early days, he could squash you. You know, you had to be really careful. And there's the old law that if you want to be supported by the powers that be, you'd better support the powers that be. So the way that Buddhism evolved, it didn't challenge the kings. It wasn't prophetic. There wasn't this prophetic voice. Yeah, we have a lot of stories of kings consulting the Buddha what to do. But he and the early Buddhists, I'm not aware of any stories where they really challenged the Buddha in a prophetic way. Sorry, they challenged the kings, the rulers, in a prophetic way. Instead, Buddhism had a teaching that could easily be used to rationalize the powers of kings. It's called the karma teaching. Right? That is to say, if somebody is born a prince and will become a king, well, he must have really good karma from his past lifetime, and we should obey him. If someone is born really poor and disabled in some way, very difficult situation, well, I'm sorry, but don't blame anybody else but yourself, you see. And furthermore, you're a woman. I'm sorry. You must have done something bad in your past lifetimes, right? But don't worry. If you do what we men say, you can hope to be reborn as a monk, as a man in the future, and maybe you can become a monastic, right? So the karma teaching could be used and was to rationalize the social order, and that's one of the major reasons, I think, why Buddhism did not develop the whole social justice thing. And so you had kings, you know, they supported the Dharma. They supported the Dharma. Wow. So they're great bodhisattvas. And some of them, like you have stories of some of the Chinese emperors called themselves Buddhas. Right? Now, if we have a Chinese emperor here with all his guards and he calls himself a Buddha, are you going to contradict him? Right? I mean, it's tricky. So, you know, Buddhism, I mean, we need to appreciate Buddhism. Something wonderful happened. The emphasis on personal transformation meant that Buddhism developed what is certainly the largest collection of contemplative practices that can help us transform ourselves individually. And that's no small accomplishment, right? When you put all those practices together, it's fantastic. But the price of that was that Buddhism did not encourage democracy or the kind of social justice, social transformation, right? So can you see where I'm going with all this? Bring this tradition together with the Western tradition. Bring the traditional Asian Buddhist emphasis on personal transformation with collective transformation or social transformation, social justice of the West, right? Bring them together, and what do we see? In a way, yeah, maybe I didn't make the point clearly, but the way of discussing the Buddhist tradition is a way of pointing out that as important as the Buddhist emphasis on individual transformation is about, nonetheless, we also have very clearly these issues of social dukkha, institutionalized dukkha, structural dukkha, the dukkha caused by governments, the dukkha caused by economic and social institutions, by corporations. The traditional Buddhism doesn't talk about that, right? But also the other side of Buddhism is that it has within itself its own self-transformative dynamic. What I mean by that is from the very beginning, Buddhism has emphasized impermanence, emphasized insubstantiality, emphasized transforming itself as well. Buddhism isn't what the Buddha said, it's what the Buddha started. And as Buddhism spread to China, for example, to Tibet, you know, it interacted with the local cultures, with the local spiritual traditions, and created something new. And now that Buddhism comes to the West, now that Buddhism comes not just to the West but to the modern world, and not just to the modern world, but a modern world in crisis, in social and ecological crisis, how is Buddhism going to respond to that, you see? I mean, that, it seems to me, is one of the main questions. If Buddhism has this potential for self-transformation in relationship to new cultures, how is Buddhism going to change in this new situation? And I think one of the consequences, one of the things that's clearly already happening, is socially engaged Buddhism. And more recently, what we're calling eco-dharma. That is to say, not just socially engaged Buddhism, but ecologically engaged Buddhism. Buddhism that is concerned to understand and respond to the ecological crisis that we're in, right? In the past, I've often talked about, as an example of this interaction and this new kind of development, one thing that I've written about at some length is what I've called the three institutionalized poisons. You remember the three poisons I talked about earlier? Very important. Greed, ill will, delusion, sometimes called the three fires, sometimes called the three roots of evil. They're as close as Buddhism comes to identifying something as evil. They're basically saying, when we're motivated by the three poisons, problems occur. It's important to transform our motivations. So instead of greed, being motivated by generosity. Instead of ill will, loving kindness. Instead of delusion, wisdom, right? Especially the wisdom of our interconnectedness, right? So that's very traditional Buddhism, and that's really important. But I think one of the things we can see pretty clearly, especially if we're open to what I call social dukkha, is that we've institutionalized these three poisons, right? Let's be honest, our economic system is institutionalized greed. If greed means you never have enough, well, that's not only applicable to consumers. Advertising keeps us thinking the next thing we buy will make us happy, right? But also corporations, which are never profitable enough, they're never big enough, they never have enough market share, their stock prices are never high enough, and more generally, national GDP, GNP is never big enough, right? But why is more and more always better if it can never be enough? That's the kind of trap we're sort of stuck in there. Institutionalized ill will. Well, as somebody who's been involved in prison dharma, I think our attitude toward inmates, toward that's pretty horrible. Our attitude toward immigrants. I mean, I'm just shocked by the hypocrisy of our immigration system, you know. We want all these immigrants to come and do all the dirty work that we don't want to do, to pay them really lousy wages, but we also want to give them a really hard time, right? They're not, you know, as if we're not all immigrants, right? But I think the best example is our militarism, you know. If you measure... If our militarism is measured by the amount of resources, the amount of money that we put into our military, let's be honest, we are by far the most militaristic society that's ever existed. And our attitude reveals it. How many countries have we bombed since World War II, you know? It's pretty shocking to look into that, you know? And this horrible thing, if you're going to have a huge military, you've got to keep finding enemies. Or there's no excuse for it. You've got to keep finding or manufacturing enemies. Otherwise, you know, the generals don't have a way to get medals, and we don't, you know. Also, the people who create the bombs, you know, you've got to replenish. I mean, there's all kinds of economic and social forces. Once you've got a huge military, you're going to be using it. Otherwise, what's the point? And then finally, I think we've institutionalized delusion. Again, in a number of ways. As a former professor, I'll be honest, I think sometimes our educational system can be understood in those terms. And even universities. I mean, more and more it seems to me they're about higher forms of job training rather than being one of these places where we step back and reflect on what we're doing. Are we a good society? Are we doing what we should be doing? To a large extent, we are, you know, more and more the educational system is just an adjunct of the economic system rather than an opportunity to try to understand the whole and where it's going, right? So do you see my point? So I've taken the three traditional Buddhist poisons and said, well, it's not very difficult to see them institutionalized in a way that they weren't in the Buddha's time, that the dukkha isn't just individual, but our society is structured this way. And the scary thing, of course, is they tend to take on a life of their own, all three of these, right? And actually, it's kind of horrifying when you really think about it. What I've really just offered you in a nutshell is a kind of a Buddhist analysis of what's wrong. And if the Buddha's right, that greed, ill, will, delusion are the fundamental problems, and we've institutionalized them and made them so powerful, it's pretty scary, right? But at least we have a handle in the sense that we have a Buddhist perspective, not the only perspective, but we have a Buddhist perspective on what's going on, right? Yeah. So, what have I tried to do? What I've basically tried to do is argue that the traditional Western, now modern concern for social justice, social transformation, restructuring our society, which has achieved a lot in the last few hundred years, it's not enough. We also need individual transformation, but also what I've argued is that the way the Buddhist tradition has developed, it hasn't focused enough on social dukkha, institutionalized structural causes of suffering. And we're now in a situation where we can see why they need each other. What we're really talking about, I think, is the two sides of freedom. Right? There's the freedom that you have in this society if you're extremely wealthy. I used to give as my example Howard Hughes, but actually there's a new example now that's coming to my mind the last, you know, why do you all laugh? Huh? Right? Sort of, it's like, you could be really wealthy. You might even be president of the United States. But that's not going to make you happy if you're still caught up in greed, ill will, delusion, narcissism, da-da-da-da-da-da. So you might be free in one way, but you're not free in another way, right? You're not free in the way that Buddhism emphasizes. But it goes the other way around, too. If you look at Myanmar, also known as Burma, right? Let's go back maybe one generation, although I'm not sure how much better it is now. But supposing that you're an elderly Buddhist monk in Myanmar and you've been following the path, and to some degree, you know, you have developed, you've awakened, you've found a lot of equanimity, serenity. And from a Buddhist perspective, there's a lot of freedom there. You understand a lot about, you've managed to cope, transform your own greed, ill will, delusion. But you are still living in a society that's structured in that way. That is to say, you're living in a society controlled by a military junta that rips off most of the wealth for the sake of a very small group of generals and their families. You can't speak freely. Your family has to be very careful what you say, what you do, or you'll be arrested by the military. That kind of freedom is important too, you see? And the basic argument that I'm making here is that today we can see both types of freedom are important, both types of freedom need each other, and we're in a position where we can see that, and our activism is something that can pursue that. What I haven't had a chance to talk about, and I'm going to stop here, is the whole notion of the bodhisattva, which I'll be talking about tomorrow morning, because I think that's what embodies bringing them together. The new understanding of the bodhisattva is somebody who continues to work on their own transformation. They continue to meditate, etc. They're doing that. But they also know that the equanimity or serenity or emptiness that they experience doing that, it's not enough just to dwell in that. It's to bring that into social engagement, right? To bring it into the world. Usually Buddhists, or so often Buddhists, have understood social engagement as a distraction from real practice. And we're at a point clearly where we need to understand we're not talking about something that distracts us from practice. We're talking about two kinds of practice. We have to understand that our engagement in the world is also practice. In fact, maybe at this point, the more important practice. And if we had more time, I would elaborate more on how the Bodhisattva path does that. But I think I've talked long enough so far. Thank you all very much. So how are we doing on time? Well, I think we still have at least half an hour for discussion. I say discussion rather than questions because it doesn't have to be a question. It can be a comment or a critique or anything you like. Please. Seem to be on different bicycles, yeah. You know, within the Buddhist tradition, I think there's a kind of interesting tension. Because on the one hand, there's an understanding that the ultimate goal is somehow a transcendence or an escape from this world. But that's not the only understanding, especially if you read Nagarjuna, if you look at the Zen masters. There's a different understanding. As Joanna Macy puts it, not escaping from this world, but kind of plunging into it, opening up more into it. And certainly that's the kind of Zen training that I received. From this perspective, we can say that the fundamental dukkha, the heart of our dukkha, has to do with the delusion of a separate self, right? Which is also the delusion of separation. I mean, we all know this teaching, this very strange counterintuitive teaching that there is no self. What the heck can that mean? Well, what it means is that our sense of self is a psychological and social construct, right? Babies aren't born with a sense of self. It has a lot to do with language, learning how to use language, and it develops the sense of an inside that's separate from the sense of an outside. The self has no meaning except insofar as it's separate from the non-self. So if the problem is self, it's also, you're really talking about the development of a sense of separation, right? And this brings me back to what is maybe my favorite all-time quotation by Nisargadatta, who said it so well. He said, "When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life flows." Beautiful, right? Wisdom and love, or wisdom and compassion, the two pillars of the Buddhist tradition. And, you know, the fundamental implication is, therefore, that at the core of our dukkha suffering is the sense that there's a me that's separate from everyone else, and therefore my well-being ultimately is separate from all of yours. And the opposite is letting go of this and realizing I'm not separate from all of you, from all of this, that we're all interconnected, that we're all part of each other. And therefore, my well-being, your well-being, it's not separate from our well-being, you see? And that implies a very different way of living in the world. And that's what I think, I mean, we can see a lot of implications. One of the implications is social. Given the kind of challenges, very serious challenges we face today socially and ecologically, we can see this way of experiencing has really important implications. It's like realizing that I'm part of all this. Well, then, rather than trying to transcend this world, in which case, you know, who gives a damn? What? I don't care what happens to all you. I'm going to nirvana or heaven or whatever, right? Instead of that, it's more, the importance of working together to deal with the kinds of problems that we have together, which include social dukkha, which includes an exploitative economic system where the gap between rich and poor is already huge, and our democratically elected Congress has just decided to make it bigger, right? With these tax reform all these euphemisms, right? Tax cuts for the rich, right? And likewise, what our economic system is doing to, what our fossil fuel system is doing to, you know. So this way of understanding what the path is about goes along very well with an understanding that emphasizes social dukkha and the bodhisattva path and our response in that way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Please. I've read figures that dispute that, by the way. Sorry. Go ahead. How well we're doing? So you would say that actually we're in pretty good shape given the way the West and the modern world has developed?
I would say there's issues galore.
Uh-huh.
But I think part of it is just the nature of humanity. I mean, we had a technological advantage. But once Japan came into its own, Zen, by the way, I like to practice Zen meditation and so they broke out and did all kinds of things.
Well, I mean, that was the way I started out talking. I don't know if you were here at the very beginning, but the argument was actually that we've achieved a great deal in the last few centuries in particular. And that would include the fact that, well, look, I mean, think about how much all of us here, the fact that we can be here, what kind of social, economic conditions over the last couple of generations have enabled us to escape from poverty and to be able to enjoy this kind of conversation and this kind of setting. I mean, I think a great deal has actually been achieved in the last few hundred years. But what I was trying to emphasize is the fact that there's pushback, there's resistance, that it would seem like in some ways one would hope that we would be going even further. And so my big argument there was, although we have this concern, we've tried to institutionalize social justice. In fact, in a lot of ways, there have been a lot of limitations, and those are connected with individual problems of greed, ill will, and delusion. So, I mean, I think there's two sides of it. On the one hand, I think a lot has been achieved, but I would also say we're in a time of real crisis whereby there's a lot of pushback. So maybe I'm missing your point there.
I'm not so sure when you speak so broadly,
I'm sorry, I have a bit of a hearing.
No fondness for the caste system of his period.
Right.
Real impulse to reform.
Right.
And that seems to be flowering. I mean, maybe it's being repressed right now, I know the political dynamic, but.
Right. Social justice, yeah.
No sangha for the women, or there was, then it
ascended. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the personal transformation you're talking about and all the things that Buddhism brings to spiritual transformation is profound.
Yeah.
I just don't know that it is the vehicle for the changing amount of the world to address, I don't know, open-minded. But
yeah, I'm to be quite honest, I'm not sure you've understood my argument that, you know, with regard to the West, the importance of social justice, which again is the highest ideal, and we've achieved a lot. The question is, why are we feeling stymied now? From the Buddhist side, what I'm arguing is that I think when we look as well as we can at the life of the Buddha and what he did, that he was a lot more progressive than the institution that formed after he died, which was focused on the individual and didn't really concern itself with social transformation or social justice. And, you know, just looking historically, the way those two have developed, and now we're in a situation where we can understand how both of those ideals, the social transformation that the West has been, you know, the highest ideal of the West, that coming into dialogue with the highest ideal of the Buddhist tradition, which involves, to some degree, you know, challenging the Buddhist institutions, which are very problematical and, you know, guess what? Corrupt, let's be honest, right? And I can probably find, if I look really hard, I can probably find some Christian equivalents, right? So trying to bring together the ideals and understand how those two might sort of reinforce each other. Yeah.
Thanks for addressing.
Okay, thank you. Yes, one and then two. Yeah, please. Go ahead.
I'm an SGI Nichiren Buddhist.
Welcome.
With an academic background in Hebrew scripture.
Oh, wow.
And working here in the office at the university in the Office of Mission and Values. So I appreciated your comment very much. As Buddhism grows in this country, in the West, don't you think that the collision between Buddhism, and I think this was your argument, the collision between Buddhism and the West, is that Buddhism and the West will both morph into something where individual change, what I would call human revolution, is done in order to bring about social change. That's just my position. The other thing is that there is a really incredible Christian theologian, Théo de Chardin, the Jesuit who worked a lot in China, whose understanding, he was an anthropologist as well as a priest, and he studied the development of the human mind. And he said when the mind became developed that it was able to be self-reflective, that's what he called sin. Because he said the person could see himself or herself outside of relationship with everything else. And I think that there's an understanding in Christian and Jewish theology, anyway, there's a movement toward an understanding of the God concept that is moving much, much closer to Buddhism in the sense of something that, you know, why bother trying to define it or call it something? It exists in yourself. It's in you, and you need to work on the development of that perfect self, that Buddha nature that you have. That in context of Vincent de Paul, who is the patron of this university, He spoke of the way of perfection, and that it was always in context of service of the poor.
Well, there's a lot of stuff there, right? Yeah, yeah. Just very briefly about self-consciousness. Sometimes I think that there's something incomplete about us. That self-consciousness, the sense of separation, so in one way necessary, in another way problematical. But self-consciousness as there's that's an important development, but there's something incomplete about it in the sense that we still think that consciousness is something that the self has or doesn't have, rather than the other way around, that maybe what we call, what we're aware of as the self, is a form that consciousness takes. And I think this is a more Buddhist approach. You know, there's this whole problem in Buddhism, if there's no self, who or what is it that becomes awakened? And this very interesting story, after the Buddha had his experience, he was challenged by Mara, who said, you know, you say you're awakened, you think you're awakened now, well, who authenticates, who verifies that? The Buddha didn't say anything. He touched the earth with his hand. And there's a sense in which, you know, it's returning to the earth. It's like, instead of me as a separate ego, realizing that I'm a manifestation or an expression, a form of something greater than myself, and all of us are. And maybe that's the point we're at now ecologically. We've got this sense of prodigal son separation from the earth, but we have to sort of go further and realize that, you know, we are one of the forms of the earth. We are, and maybe we have a very special function to play in terms of helping the earth to heal and so forth. Anyway, but thank you. You touched on a lot of things. I just thought I'd pick out that little one in particular. Charles, you wanted to say something?
Someone tries to straddle these two poles that you're talking about. What I struggle with is this. Lots of folks would argue that the dualistic thinking that you were talking about, the ultimate form of that is a transcendent God over against a created universe. From the prophet's point of view, that's a good thing, in the sense that they see themselves modeled after Exodus, in which Moses has what some scholars would call a court of appeal over against Lord Pharaoh and the ideologies of Pharaoh's put into play.
Right.
They have, in their case, someone that they can point to as the Supreme Court, and that essentially what the prophets are doing is
right.
On behalf of the poor and the marginal. So if you're poor and oppressed, it's really good to have that kind of
God on your side.
And I'm just, I'm just, as a Buddhist part of me,
right.
What kind of court of appeals do Buddhists have? How can we internalize some kind of a Supreme Court?
The example of the prophets, great question. The example of the prophets, it seems to me, what they were doing, as you presented, is a pretty good example of what we call the axial age in general, right? And to put that in context, what I said about the Greeks, that was an axial age development, the sense of separation, the sense that, you know, we can restructure society. But more generally, what was before the axial age, I mentioned these hierarchical societies that people just accepted. What did it mean to be religious in those societies? Well, there was no separation between political and religious power. It's like the king was also a god or a head priest, right? So to be religious there, you are playing your role in a kind of totalitarian system where you support the king is the one, or is the god, the one relating to the heavens, to the gods, you see. So at that point, there's no Supreme Court, as you say. And what's really important about the axial age is suddenly you get this new development that there's a god who's so high and so great that in a way it levels everyone else, so that, like Luther, right? How was Luther able to do what he did? He was able to challenge the larger society, because he thought God was on his side, you see. So that was a really important development for social justice as well. The problem we've gotten into now, today, is I think the limitations, because that's that other dualism you spoke of, the dualism that there's a higher reality, God, heaven. God created this world, and since our goal is ultimately to spend eternity with God in heaven, inevitably there's going to be some devaluation of this world. I mean, in one way, it doesn't really matter very much if our ultimate destiny is somewhere else. And I think that's the situation we find ourselves in now in relationship to the earth. We still feel separate from the earth. We still feel intermediate between God and the earth. The earth is, you know, God may have created it, but it's not sacred in the way that he is. So the Buddhist approach is quite different because it's more non-dual at its best. And again, I think within the Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of versions, a lot of different tendencies. But fundamentally, what Buddhism comes down to is the kind of realization that I quoted with Nisargadatta, that ultimately, by undercutting the delusion of separation, by letting go of the sense of self, one is also letting go of all of the, I mean, ultimately, letting go of all the selfish tendencies that the self is inclined to get caught up in, you see. So a really deep realization that involves letting go of the sense of self, forgetting yourself and realizing your non-duality with everyone else, the implication there is that thereby one isn't going to focus on one's own well-being separate from the whole. You see, it kind of functions in a different sort of way. There was something else I was going to say. Does that help at all? Taigen, you want to get in here?
Well, in some sense, then, the Court of Appeals, Buddhism is what Buddha did, because the earth. Call on the earth itself, the universe itself, to witness to how to respond.
So to feel that I'm a, like, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. The realization that which takes form as me is also taking form as you. That there's this kind of non-separation, I think, is the real sort of heart of the Buddhist message, and the ethical follows from that. My teacher, Yamada Koen, made a point of emphasizing that any genuine kensho, any genuine realization, is spontaneously accompanied by deep compassion. It's just that's the other side of it. And the compassion is the root of the concern for whether poor people are suffering or et cetera, et cetera. So in a way, there's an ethical implication built into a kind of ontological realization about the way the world really is and who I am and my relationship with the world, if that makes any sense. Yeah. You know, it gets tricky, though, because, like, talking about all the abuses, we have all of these so-called great Buddhist teachers, Zen, Tibetan, and there's so many abuses, you know, it raises questions. The point being, you can have some taste of this, you can have some experience of non-duality, but somehow in Buddhism, there's too much the idea that you have this experience and then you're transformed, you know, and it just doesn't work like that. You might have a little glimpse of something, but nonetheless, those deep-rooted, self-centered tendencies are still there, and that's the real practice, is sort of rooting them out and learning to integrate and live in a different way. And I think Santikara wants to get in here.
Yeah, something that fits well with your main thesis is, try to just have a few examples. I keep getting emails from environmental human rights
in other organizations that use fear-mongering as our political and military system does, and a fundraising technique pioneered by Jim Jones in San Francisco when he was a homeless activist, that give us $2 or $3. That was invented by Jim Jones, Jamestown, or Jonestown.
Ouch.
Late guy. It's, so to me, unless our justice work, which in the States is professionalized within the nonprofit industry, unless it does its inner work, both the individuals and the organizations, it's going to be using the sick tools that I just mentioned, and therefore sabotaging its own work. And then on, say, the Buddhist side, I've spent months, recent months, with friends trying to get one of the major Buddhist publications to be more transparent about a blatant example of patriarchy. A certain group of Western monks based in the West, not Asian monks, who continue to oppress women within their system. And this magazine gave one of the spokesperson of this a free pass on an issue that was supposedly ethics for the 21st century. And besides the unseemliness of that and the magazine protecting its power because it's a broker in the Buddhist world, people have to kind of brown nose to get in. There's that, but as a former Buddhist monk of many years standing, one reason I'm not is stuck in that patriarchy that you talked about in various ways. How can you really awaken when you're a privileged being who does not have to face? And like here in the West now, I've had to learn, now that I have credit cards and stuff, nobody to chauffeur me around. How valid is the awakening of these pampered, privileged
white males?
or they could be golden or brown, whatever, who are in a system that protects them, coddles them, pampers them, and distorts their own ability to actually face the suffering. You know, we just do it through TV. So I've gone on too far, but I'm trying to say that as long as Buddhism is stuck in patriarchy, and I don't just mean gender,
right,
it's now classes.
Yep.
And it's got all these, like bell hooks version of patriarchy. It's class, it's racial, and gender, and other things. How can you awaken if you're stuck in that? My argument is you can't, because your psyche is so walled off into a little box. You're only awakening within a little box. So unless we have ways to take apart these structures, we cannot awaken. That might have been different 300 years ago. I don't know. Oh, right now I can't see it. And both systems are in crisis.
Yeah.
Buddhism is falling apart structurally. And here in America, it's just sucking up to capitalism.
Yeah, what you're reminding me of is how much, what's the word, how every religious institution is kind of the graveyard of the founder's teachings. It organizes itself in that fashion, really. It's like when I can look at, say, the Thai Sangha, you know, we can look at the Vatican, excuse me. You know, it take your pick is this constant tension. The founder comes along with some real transformative message, and the goal of the institution is somehow to domesticate it, to monetize it, you know, to somehow thrive on institutionalizing it, and in a way that doesn't really threaten the society anymore, and so that's Buddhism, Christianity, you just find it all over again, and that's the challenge. And the other religious institution that I would add to that is consumerism, capitalism, you know, which I think is, we really need to think about it as a religious institution in the sense that it's promising us, it's teaching us what's important and how to live and how to become happy. And, you know, all of those are very dangerous. Yeah. So was somebody had a hand up over on this side? Please. Okay, both of you, sorry. Yeah.
What I'm thinking here, I'm wondering if you pointed out earlier, was the importance of actually doing, of actually acting. And I think that's the thing that we sometimes get too caught up in, is discussing what the place of social action and
right.
everything else.
Right. Well, there are some, you know, there are groups who are trying to go in that direction, you know. I mean, we have Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and more, like in Boulder, we have an Eco-Dharma group as well as our new Eco-Dharma Center. In terms of Buddhism, however, I think it's important to say, you know, Buddhism, like Christianity, it developed at a time when we didn't have an ecological crisis, and so you're not going to find specific answers in those teachings what to do. But Buddhism has a great deal to say about how it is that we do whatever we do.
I think that's the crucial.
Yeah.
Is seeing that
right, but also doing something along those lines. Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the, as someone who spent a lot of time studying social psychology, it's very important to realize that it isn't always that we change our attitudes and then we change our behavior. In fact, it's more often that if we can get people to change their behavior, that changes their attitude.
There's a lot of emphasis in Buddhism on motivation, you know, intentions. And sometimes people can misunderstand that and think that it's just enough to sort of, you know, change your attitude. I remember Bhikkhu Bodhi telling the story of, you know, Buddhists will go up and maybe have a meditation retreat where they work on metta. Metta is basic friendliness, compassion, and you're generating all this metta for yourself, for your friends, family, other people, ultimately all beings in the universe. And so they'll generate this metta. They'll maybe spend a week on this metta meditation, and then they finish and they go home. And they live the same way. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, well, wait a minute, something's missing here. You know, the whole idea is not just changing your attitude, which some forms of Buddhism emphasize, but actually engaging with the world in a way different because of that more different attitude. Yes, sir, in the back. Right.
He was meeting with Buddhists.
Right.
But he also spoke on a prophetic tradition, dealing with social action.
The war.
Motivating to many people.
Right.
That was one example. But the other one that you might be more as familiar with, and I think this was around 2010 or 2012, it's 5-6 years ago anyway, in Myanmar. If the BBC reporting of this was accurate, the monks who would go out in the morning get their alms would not receive alms from the general.
That's right. They turn their bowls upside down.
If you're familiar with that, could you comment on that as maybe both of these being examples of the reality of what you're trying to present to us as East or Buddhist and Abraham meeting. I saw it especially in the monks in Myanmar.
Right.
More recently, and it seemed greater implications, at least to their life.
Yeah.
When they would not receive the Angha. What might that have meant within Buddhism?
Yeah. Santikaro, do you have a better sense of that? You were a monastic in Thailand for so many years, but had you already come back to the U.S. by then in terms of your sense of what was going on there?
Yeah, not in touch with Burma, but the concept is quite old. In Thai, it's called Quan Ba. You overturn your bowl. So if lay people are behaving badly, send them a best message, you don't receive alms food, but it goes the other way. There were monks who were caught up in bickering and behaving badly, and the Buddha sent people to tell the local people, don't feed them, and they'll shape up really quickly.
So the opposite, I think, actually.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just the generals, it was the military.
Yeah.
Right.
Because it's, the generals probably didn't care. But they
didn't,
soldiers were the targets as well.
How far back does that tradition go, do you think, of overturning the bowl?
It goes back to stories from the Buddha's time.
So?
How far historically could Buddhist notion of history and our modern notion of history are quite different.
I think
it goes back a long way, though not often practiced due to the domestication you mentioned.
Yeah.
I just saw it as from the Abrahamic traditions. Actually, not Abrahamic, the prophets. They followed down, I think. It was a prophetic action, which at the meeting, the underlying, as I heard it reported, compassion that was expressed in the monk's risky action, which also reverberated into the institutions of the West that are represented by the generals. I think, So, I mean, they may, I don't know.
That was mainly Mandalay, I believe, which is
pretty far north.
And was a hotbed of the activism. And I don't think that happened so much throughout the country. And it was not all monks. But there were enough of them in Mandalay, maybe that area, to have a noticeable impact on ordinary soldiers.
That's as much as I can say. I think it's a great thing, and I'm happy we have that within the Buddhist tradition.
And from Thai Buddhism, I can point to similar stories going back at least a few hundred years, but there are exceptions to the general domestication of the institution. But there have always been, as Merton said, marginal people, monks.
Right. And there's also, I didn't really say much, but of course the Judeo-Christian tradition, or I should say the Christian tradition, it has the contemplative side to it, doesn't it? I mean, I didn't mean to ignore that, but so often, I'm very inspired and interested in reading people like Meister Eckhart, or Juan de la Cruz, and so forth. There's clearly a lot there that resonates with, for example, my Zen tradition. But what's interesting, though, is how in the modern world Christianity tends to have lost that. So there's that whole contemplative side, and once monasticism became de-emphasized, interestingly, my Zen teacher in Kamakura, Japan, was very popular internationally, especially Europeans, especially Christian clergy, because they were coming to practice Zen in order to revive, rediscover the contemplative tradition within their own religions. So somehow it wasn't like they were abandoning Christianity to practice Buddhism. Rather, they were really concerned about recuperating something that had been there at one time but had been largely lost. Yeah. I'm wondering about the time. Tom, do you want to wrap up, or I don't know if there's anything to say. I did bring a very few books in the back if anyone wants to buy them, but there are just a couple there.
I do want to ask everyone to join me in thanking David.